From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He who holds the king's ear holds true power, the saying goes, and a remarkable number of the men who have President Bush's ear right now, top global strategists and advisors, are staunch followers of one Leo Strauss, a long-dead but very potent political philosopher who didn't trust liberal democracy and preferred to see power in the hands of a secretive elite. And now, it is. The Straussians are riding high in Washington tonight on Point Leo Strauss and the philosophy behind the men behind the president. We begin in Washington with the House Armed Services Committee last night rejected a Bush administration proposal to repeal a ban on the development of new, small nuclear weapons. But the story isn't over. I spoke earlier with James Dow, State Department reporter for the New York Times. I asked him why the Bush administration is pushing a new breed of nuclear arms.
The Bush administration is saying they don't have any specific plans to build new weapons. What they are looking for is the authority to begin research on what they call a low-yield nuclear weapon. And by low-yield, they mean a weapon that's about a third the size of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. There's been no request from the uniformed military to build such a weapon. The Pentagon, however, is saying that they'd like to start research for two reasons. One is they want to know what these types of weapons can do because they think the Russians are trying to build these kinds of small weapons, and they think that other countries, some of the new emerging nuclear powers, North Korea, for instance, might have these kinds of weapons.
So Donald Rumsfeld, as far as I understand, has made clear that he believes this is a capacity or a kind of weapon that the United States may one day need. What would be the purpose of a small nuclear weapon?
There's actually two ideas, two thoughts for why the United States might someday want this kind of weapon. One is that it's considered a what you might call a clean way of destroying chemical or biological agents. And by that we mean there's always been a concern about how do you destroy a stockpile or a weapons factory that has anthrax or other types of biological or chemical agents. If you just blow it up with a conventional weapon, you might release all these agents into the atmosphere and poison people downwind. A nuclear device, on the other hand, because of the immense amount of heat it would release, would incinerate all these things. Now, opponents of these weapons say, well, that's an absurd argument because you're using an atomic device with nuclear fallout and you're creating all kinds of other problems. But that is one of the notions for why you might want to build these weapons.
So clearly in the administration there's an interest in researching and in being ready to develop these, but it's been hotly debated on Capitol Hill. What's been the outcome of committees in the Senate and House in the last week?
There's been two different outcomes. The Senate Armed Service Committee approved the repeal of a law that banned the research that could lead to development of these types of weapons. In other words, they did what the Bush administration requested. They lifted a 10-year-old law that would have stopped research and development into these types of weapons. The House Armed Services Committee, on the other hand, decided to maintain the ban in a slightly amended form, but essentially they rejected the Bush administration's request. This isn't over necessarily. There will be a fight on the Senate floor where mainly Democrats will attempt to keep the ban in place, and there may be a fight on the House floor, we don't know yet, by some people to get the ban repealed. So this is a slow process. It may take weeks for it to play out.
James Dow, my understanding is that even the House move would permit research to go away while not lifting the ban on development of these weapons. Is that correct?
Yes, it would allow research into weapons, but make very clear that there could be nothing leading towards development or testing or procurement of these types of weapons. And some people, including some people who were supporters of the original ban, said that that was the case anyway, that there was a certain amount of scientific research into small weapons that would have always been possible. The Pentagon had made the argument that the law was murky, that it was chilling scientific research, and that they just wanted the ban on research and development completely lifted.
And what about the proliferation argument, that if the United States goes forward with this kind of research, others will be tempted to do the same? What are we hearing from administration officials on that front?
That's a very powerful argument. At least opponents of these weapons feel it's a very powerful argument. They say that if we're moving ahead with these types of small weapons, how on earth can we tell North Korea or Iran not to develop nuclear weapons? The administration makes the case that these countries don't care what we do. They're moving ahead with their own weapons. they are flouting existing nuclear weapons treaties, and that it shouldn't matter, that we should move ahead to do what's best for our defense, because Iran and North Korea are not going to take their cues from us anyway.
And James, what's the timetable for this being settled, at least in this round in Congress? Does it have to come together or to a resolution as part of Pentagon spending legislation?
It does, yes. The debate is wrapped up as part of the fiscal 2004 defense authorization bill, which they hope to wrap up by summer, although that's not always the case. But chances are that they're going to try to deal with this within the next month.
And we see Democrats saying that either way, what we have here is Washington pushing into research into new weapons, into new nuclear weapons. Is that a fair characterization?
That is a fair characterization of what they're saying. They do think that this is just sort of the camel's nose under the tent, that the Bush administration, even though it's saying it has no plans right at this moment to develop new weapons, is interested in developing these kinds of new weapons because they believe, and the Bush administration has said that these new weapons might be important someday. They're not ruling that out. But the Democrats and arms control advocates think that there is a general push within the Bush administration not only to develop new weapons, but perhaps to start underground testing again. Again, the Bush administration says it has no plans to do that, but it has taken some sort of small steps in those directions.
James Dow, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
James Dow is State Department reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. Winston Churchill said that in wartime, truth is so precious that it should be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Classic Churchill, but it might well have been a line from Leo Strauss. Born in Germany in 1899, this esoteric political philosopher watched with dismay as Germany's democracy crumbled into fascism. He left Europe and came to America deeply skeptical of the strength of liberal democracy. There are truths the people can't handle, he believed, truths that are best left to a governing elite who speak a secret code. According to followers of Leo Strauss, and there are many in and around the Bush administration, it's a doctrine designed to protect democracy from itself and from its enemies. Don't announce your real intent. Announce what sells, what consoles, what misleads, if necessary, for the greater good. But is that democracy? We're digging into Leo Strauss and his acolytes tonight. Can democracy be run by elites with a hidden agenda? Can you feel the Straussian streak in Washington today? Does democracy need a hard and hidden guiding hand? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Harvey Mansfield, professor of government and political philosophy at Harvard University. He is co-author, most recently, of a translation of Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Good evening and a warm welcome, Professor Harvey Mansfield.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Calgary, Canada, is Shadia Drury. She was recently appointed the Canada Research Chair in Social Justice at the University of Regina, Saskatchewan, and is author of Leo Strauss and the American Right. Good evening and welcome, Shadia Drury.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Harvey Mansfield, let me dive in with you, if I may. I know this is a famously nuanced and difficult philosopher, Leo Strauss, open to interpretation in many ways, but and has been interpreted in many ways by many different people. But share with us, if you would, the core of the insight, the view, the vision of this philosopher, Leo Strauss, as it pertains to politics and the conversation that's going on today.
Well, the first thing to say is that it pertains more to philosophy than to politics. He made two main points in his works. Mm-hmm. One was a distinction between ancient and modern political philosophy, and another was a distinction between esoteric and exoteric writing. He thought that philosophers, and especially the ancient philosophers, but also some of the modern ones, engaged in a form of communication with other philosophers. That was esoteric, that you had to be philosophic to understand.
That is, exoteric would be visible to all, esoteric kind of hidden between the lines.
That's right. And he was, Strauss was an historian of philosophy. He was a philosopher who thought that one had to concentrate on the history of philosophy. And the books that he wrote never contained any doctrine or any political doctrine, but rather were written on Plato and Aristotle and Thucydides and Xenophon, some of these rather obscure authors whose texts he read with enormous care and explained with impressive insight. And he gathered together with him a number of acolytes, if you like, but I would say students or mm-hmm. followers. Mm-hmm. I'm one of them, mm-hmm. Who constitute a minority in the political philosophy profession, that's for sure, but who are more or less dedicated followers, not unanimous in their views, but those are the people which you would call Straussians. And he was very controversial. Nobody is neutral on Leo Strauss.
Why was he so controversial, Harvey Mansfield?
He was controversial because he was thought to be conservative. His politics were thought to be conservative. He once said that he was in the odor of conservatism, but also because of this doctrine of esoteric communication or esoteric writing.
And it's been said that he, in his view, only philosophers can handle the truth. Is that a fair summary of Leo Strauss, and how does it translate into democracy?
Right. No, that's not a fair summary. But he said that only philosophers can raise the philosophic questions most uncompromisingly. Everybody has a little bit of philosophy in him.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is that we all stop too soon. The philosopher does it full time and never stops.
So,
being a thinker, he questions, and when he questions the views that most of us hold for true or take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is subversive not only of democracy but of any society, because a philosopher questions not only the principles of democracy, but of monarchy or whatever.
Shadi Drury, let me bring you in. How do you see the philosophy, the teaching of Leo Strauss translating into contemporary politics and power brokering today?
Well, I agree with Harvey that Strauss mainly made a huge distinction between ancients and modern philosophers, and that was a critical distinction. But it wasn't just a distinction for him. He had gave a special value to the ancients. So he said that the ancients were wise and good and smart, whereas the moderns were sort of stupid and vulgar. And so and Harvey's also right to say that Strauss never put down a political doctrine, but it's not too hard to discover his political doctrine, because it's easy to attribute to him the ideas that he attributed to the wise, namely the great ancients. So if you look at someone like Plato, whom he admired, for example, Plato was a huge critic of democracy,
mm-hmm.
and so was Strauss. But their criticisms of democracy are, to a large extent, criticisms that people who are devoted to democracy and who are living in democracies should heed, because they are criticisms of some value. So, for example, in a democracy, we think every Tom, Dick, Harry, and George can be a ruler, whereas Socrates said, no, it takes a special kind of talent, it takes a special kind of character to rule. And Strauss also thought it took a special kind of character, a special kind of ability to be in a position of power. And the question is, what kind of ability was that? What did Plato think it was, and what did Strauss think it was? It's not clear that they are exactly the same on that.
Jack Beatty, if you'll stand by, we're going to have to take a short break here, and I want to come back and dig into how all this is being expressed today in Washington, in the Bush administration, by students of Leo Strauss, political philosopher, now long dead, but very, very influential in the current conversation in and around the Bush administration. We're talking tonight about Leo Strauss and the philosophy behind the men, behind the president. You can join the conversation. Does truth require a bodyguard of lies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Leo Strauss and the philosophy behind the men behind the president. My guests tonight are Harvey Mansfield, professor of government and political philosophy at Harvard University and translator most recently of Tocqueville's Democracy in America. From Calgary, Canada, Shadia Drury, recently appointed Canada Research Chair in Social Justice at the University of Regina, Saskatchewan, and author of Leo Strauss and the American Right, and our own Jack Beattie is with us tonight. You can join as well. Are there truths about the world that the American people just can't handle? Or does democracy presume that the people will step up? Does it give you comfort or make you nervous to have Straussians in the driver's seat? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in. You know how this kind of there's been this explosion just in the last few weeks in the New York Times and the Boston Globe, elsewhere, about is Washington being driven by a cabal of Straussians who don't trust democracy, who don't believe in truth in political communication, who have a hidden agenda and are off to the races with it? What do you make of this, Jack?
Well, if Leo Strauss is fairly represented, and I leave to our philosophers whether this is fair or not, if he's fairly represented by Stephen Holmes' characterization that he believed that political communication was inherently deceptive, if that was his main teaching, then what do we make of this? According to the New Yorker's Seymour Hersh, the two people who run the Defense Special Intelligence Unit, the Defense Department, Abram Shulsky and Stephen Camboni, are both Straussians. We're both studied students of Strauss or of his works. And what do we know about that unit? Well, we know that, to put it very bluntly, they cooked the intelligence. They reinterpreted, you might say, the evidence of the Iraq's alleged links to Osama bin Laden and the possession of weapons of mass destruction. They reinterpreted such evidence as there was to support those in the administration who wanted to go to war. This is just coming out now one level at a time. We have talked about it. We've exposed it. We've had guests who've done it. This is clear. So what were they engaged in? Deception. And where do they learn that? Why were they engaged in deception? What was the purpose? Why couldn't they come out and say what the war was for? I don't know. But I do find it interesting that Richard Perle and Douglas Fife, who are also Defense Department officials and who are also Straussians, in 1996 wrote a paper for the Likud party in Israel when it was taking power, saying that the Israeli government should use preemptive action to topple the regime in Baghdad, to topple the regime in Syria, to install monarchies there, and don't worry about Oslo. This will overawe the Palestinians. You won't have to give up territory, give up those settlements, and you'll just be able to stay there, and everything will be fine because you'll have righted the Middle East. Well, Israel didn't do that, but we did it. And I guess the question is, did we do it for Israel? And if that were the reason, why couldn't our policymakers say it?
Shadia Drury, come in here. Do you see, you've studied Leo Strauss closely. Do you see a justification, Leo Strauss, for this kind of political deception? And more immediately, do you see an American democracy being strung along, being sort of led by the nose by Straussians in Washington? Or does that seem overblown to you?
No, it doesn't seem that overblown. The thing is that Strauss is often criticized for being an elitist. But what is it? What society has ever not been elitist? Every society is elitist to some extent, or elitist, or has some elite that is governing it. Even liberal society, liberals are also elitists. Mm-hmm. They just believe that the elite is not born to rule. It's not a feudal elite born to rule, but the elite is those who have money and wealth and are able to finance expensive campaigns and are able to go to the best law schools, etc. But my criticism of Strauss is not that he was an elitist, but that kind of elite that he cultivated is what worries me. That I think it's an unscrupulous, deceptive, and manipulative elite that he cultivated. But it wasn't intended in a sinister sense. It was intended only because he had no faith in people's rationality, in their capacity to make rational choices. And he had faith in the sort of wise few, the enlightened few who can lead the people by the nose and who know what's good for others without having to give people a chance to choose or to think rationally whatsoever. And these few are justified to do everything. So the many, there's one rule for the many for Strauss and another rule for the few. The many should really basically weep, worship, and sacrifice, whereas the few, they don't have to abide by any particular rules at all. They have a right to commit crimes, even if these crimes will lead to ultimate good. They may be vilified in their lifetime, but in the long, long run, if they succeed, they will be deified. They will be honored. Mm. They will be praised.
Harvey Mansfield, there's a pretty tough laying out of the Straussian way. You are a Straussian. You've taught and made Straussians. William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, very influential in Washington now, one of your own students. When you hear Straussians described as unscrupulous, manipulative, and you just heard Shadia's sort of laying out of this crew, does it ring true to you? Is this what you're teaching?
It seems an almost total distortion to me. In the first place, as to what Jack Beatty said, Fife and Pearl are not Straussians. Camboni, I don't believe, is one. I've never heard of him. Only Abe Schulsky is a Straussian. Straussians don't believe in a political secretive elite with a hidden agenda. And I think looking at the Bush administration's Iraq policy as a whole, or the war against terrorism, you may or may not agree with it, but I think you would have to say that it's been principled in that the goals and the methods of it have been laid out to the public, and the actions have corresponded to those principles. Now, of course, it's true as you quoted from Churchill that truth needs a bodyguard of lies. So if you're carrying out a political campaign, and especially a war, you're not going to tell the enemy everything that's going to happen to them, although we went a considerable distance in that regard. So I think there are cases in which anyone would admit that in politics, lying is necessary. And in ordinary life, a kind of tactful lying, telling of white lies, is always necessary. But the big point of distortion that I see in what everybody is saying is that they're politicizing Strauss. Strauss's open and public agenda was that he wanted to revive the study of political philosophy. So he had an academic or a university or a philosophical point in mind. He wasn't trying to take over American government.
But Straussians have gone into American government.
Well,
doesn't that lead ipso facto to a kind of politicizing of Strauss? They are in the political world.
Well, that's right. So they try to use what they've learned from Strauss. That's perfectly correct. One reason, by the way, that they're in the political world is that they weren't able to get academic jobs not being liberals. And by the way, most of these quotations that you've been reading
flying fast and furious,
come from the liberal press. And I think it's a kind of attempt to get at the Bush administration through the back door.
So you see this whole kind of flurry of interest in Straussians and the sinister vogue of Strauss as purely political. Shadi Drury, what do you make of that? Hello, Shadi Drury, are you there? Nope. Jack, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Good. Maybe you'd better step in. I think we've lost Shadi for a moment. You hear how Harvey's summing this up. It's just a way of undercutting people in government who are trying to do their job in a reasonable fashion.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly opposed to the Bush administration's policies, and so I'm using this evidence, and I guess I could fit that rubric. But I'm not just using it because I'm against Bush. It bothers me, I guess. I would defer to the professor on all matters, but it bothers me that people who admired Plato and Plato's notion of the noble lie and the sort of picture of the philosopher king and so on, it bothers me that a philosopher who thought highly of that should have influenced people so high in our government. I rather wish that that these were Rawlsians, you see, that it was John Rawls who was the philosophical godfather of this administration. But that's another story.
But ultimately, it's not Jack Beatty's politics that matter here. But I guess it is democracy that must matter in the United States. Is a Straussian hand in Washington a problem for democracy?
Well, if the issue is that the people can't be trusted with the truth, and that the people, because they will do imprudent things for the state, if that's the sort of a kind of Straussian vision seen in Machiavelli and so on, and coming out of his historical experience in Weimar Germany, if that's transposed to the United States and the people who are making policy believe that, that does poison democracy. Because, you know, the people can make choices. We are not a mass. And this view that refugees like Professor Strauss and others had, that there was this dreadful mass out there, was really given the lie by Franklin Roosevelt, by the New Deal, which showed that the mass, when you told them the truth, when you tried to deal with their problems, wasn't some you know, festering mob. People could make sound judgments if given the truth.
Shadi Drury, do we have you back? Yes, yeah. Please do. We lost you for a moment, but we want to hear what you're thinking.
Well, a couple of things. One is about political philosophy. Strauss did want to revive political philosophy, but the question is, what did he mean by it? And he writes that in a famous article called What is Political Philosophy? Mm. And he says very clearly that political philosophy is the political face that philosophy must give to the world, because philosophy in itself is extremely dangerous, politically disastrous, because a society needs faith. Society needs religion. Society needs commitment. Society cannot stand the kind of question, the kind of the kind of nihilism, the atheism of philosophy. So the truths of philosophy is that there is no God, there's no rational foundation for morality, and these are very, very dangerous truths. In other words, I consider him a postmodern thinker in the sense that he shared Nietzsche's idea that every claim to truth is a disguised manifestation of the will to power.
What
do you do with that?
Well, you've been described by Jeet here in the Globe as saying that Leo Strauss had the pretense of American patriotism, but that it hid a cynical and extremist anti-democratic ideology. Is that a fair characterization of what you think? And then what should we make of the fact that there are Straussians in high and powerful positions in this government?
I think we should distinguish between liberalism and democracy. I don't think Strauss was quite as hostile to democracy as he was to liberalism. Liberalism is about freedom of individuals and minorities under the rule of law. And liberals would be quite satisfied with a constitutional monarchy that protected individual liberty. Democracy is about rule of the majority. The fact that we have the combination of liberalism and democracy, these are sort of very different bedfellows. They are an odd couple, if you want. And one of the things, people have also said I was a Straussian because I'm not sympathetic to democracy, but I'm a liberal critic of democracy because I fear, like most liberals do, the tyranny of the majority that could be involved in democracy.
But the American Constitution itself is supposed to guard against that,
not to be
put into the hands of an elite that sees themselves even further buttressed by some special standing.
Exactly. I mean, I think that an elite that sees itself as sort of exempt from the rules that apply to everyone else is an elite that would abuse power.
And when Harvey Mansfield said all of this is just a political attack on the conservatives in power in Washington, it's all political, that this isn't justified, that this is a kind of way of smearing or disempowering the people that President Bush has brought to power. Well, how do you respond?
I just think that it's a valid criticism of the people that he's brought to power, but it's not a criticism in the sense it's not to say that they're all sort of have a hidden sinister agenda. Their agenda is actually not completely identical to the Leo Strauss agenda when it comes to foreign policy, because to be a neoconservative, you have to believe, one, in capitalism. And Strauss didn't have anything to say about capitalism, nor did he have much regard for it. But he inspired their social policies, the emphasis on religion, the emphasis on family values, the emphasis on nationalism, that these are the things that drive society. But as far as their foreign policy is concerned, their foreign policy, if we believe they're sincere, and I happen to think they are sincere, their foreign policy is intended to make the whole world safe for liberal democracy American style, which is to say a commercial democracy. Now, Strauss would think that's quite laughable, actually. I mean, he'd think it's bizarre and laughable a goal to have for two reasons. One, because it's a very difficult thing to achieve. And secondly, if it's achieved, it's not very desirable. Mm. Strauss did not think that wealth, commercial democracy would be a very desirable thing. A theocracy is closer to what he thought would be a stable type of government.
Well, Shadi Drury, Harvey Mansfield, we have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let me invite them in. Mark is calling from Arlington, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Say, you know, your last guest is a great jumping off point for me. I happen to be the Wisconsin State Chair of something called the Democratic Freedom Caucus,
okay,
which is a libertarian group within the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm,
little L libertarians. And what I had called in to say was that I think there is a certain degree of what the philosopher in question has to say that's very true. You do need, as Orwell said, you know, the hard men to stand guard so the free man can sleep in his bed at night.
Mm.
That's true. And you don't tell the public about everything. But the Bush administration, you know, possibly for ideological reasons, enhanced by the tremendous historical, you know, outfall of 9/11, have become almost a paranoid, insular state, manipulating, as you know, as classically we see in Machiavelli, by any means necessary. And I mean, I think we saw a tendency toward that early on in the Bush administration.
But what's the evidence of that, Mark? Harvey Mansfield is saying, "Come on, they're transparently doing what they say they'll do."
Sure. Well, I mean, look at the tendency first that starts with the Bush administration that would do anything to win, including assassinating the character of John McCain. You know, to do it. Add to that 9/11, and it pushes this into high gear. And, you know, if you want evidence, just go look in the Project for a New American Century. They've been writing about taking advantage of a kind of situation that 9/11 gave you to implement, you know, a hard power agenda across the world. And look, you know, what amazes me is that they had a perfectly good war with which to implement this agenda going in Afghanistan that I, as a liberal Democrat, thought was fantastic. And, I still want to hunt down and kill the people that did 9/11. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But now it's spun out of control.
But don't tack on a whole slave full. Mark, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, our time is running down. But you hear the concern in caller Mark's view of what's going on here.
Well, yes, and Richard Perle, who, at least according to the New Yorker, has been influenced by Strauss. Last July, he had a briefing at the Pentagon for the Defense Policy Board, and they had the briefer was a former Lyndon LaRouche person who gave a series of briefs saying basically the United States should say to Saudi Arabia, stop your propaganda against the United States, round up your terrorists, or we're going to seize your oil field. And his last slide said Iraq is the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia the strategic pivot, Egypt the prize. In other words, let's knock these regimes over. I find that very frightening that kind of talk is going on in the Pentagon. Could we hear that in the public?
But the Lyndon LaRouche gang is hardly a fan of Leo Strauss. We've got a lot more to talk about tonight. We're looking at philosopher Leo Strauss and the philosophy behind the men, behind the president. Can real democracy be run by elites with a hidden agenda? Does truth require a bodyguard of lies? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Leo Strauss and the philosophy behind the men behind the president. My guests tonight are Harvey Mansfield, professor of government and political philosophy at Harvard University, and Shadia Drury, joining us from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, recently appointed Canada Research Chair in Social Justice at the University of Regina, Saskatchewan, author of Leo Strauss and the American Right. You can join us as well. President Bush said his favorite political philosopher was Jesus Christ. Should he have said Leo Strauss? Is liberal democracy intrinsically too weak to defend itself without a hard and hidden guiding hand? And in the Bush administration, do you feel a Straussian dictate to disguise true agendas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Heather's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I know you're trying to conduct this discussion at a very high philosophical level.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But about 30 years ago at Cornell, there was a Straussian cult. And Paul Wolfowitz was in it. He mm-hmm. was a member of the Telluride Association, an excellent organization. But there was a very strong Straussian impulse at the university level then. And I've heard other names, Pearls and so forth, mentioned in the last few minutes. But I think it's important to know that Wolfowitz, who is really one of our key policymakers, is deeply imbued in Straussianism.
He's certainly a key policymaker, but is it a good thing or a bad thing in your mind, Heather, that he's a student of Leo Strauss?
It's not a bad thing to be a student of Strauss, but I'm concerned about the debasement of Strauss, and I think that Shadi has identified some important elements here of how the concepts of Strauss can work down and up in policymaking and politics. And I think it's important to know that Wolfowitz was being deeply educated in Strauss when he was very young.
Yeah, great. Thanks for calling in, Heather. And I guess this much is on the record, Harvey Mansfield, and known. But what about this idea that Heather raises of the debasement of Strauss? You complained earlier that what we see here is a kind of effort to turn a philosophy into politics. But when Straussians go into politics, go into the field of governance, doesn't the philosophy come with them? How do you see it being played out? Is it being debased in practice?
No, I don't think it is. In the first place, I don't recognize or most of the things that Strauss said and what Shadia and Jack Beatty have said about him. I would say that if you wanted a real Straussian philosopher for America, a philosopher of democracy, it would be Tocqueville, not John Rawls.
Why so?
Tocqueville. Tocqueville because he accepted the fundamental truth and power of democracy in our country, but he tried to instruct it in its problems and in its defects and its weaknesses. So he didn't flatter democracy. He was a friend to democracy, and I think Strauss could be said to be the very same thing.
Is that a way of saying this is a system that endorses an elite to supplement the weaknesses of democracy?
No, it isn't. There isn't. It doesn't have. It isn't run with an elite. America is a country which Tocqueville says, and I think he's correct, is run by the people. And whatever elites we have are the elites which have been set there, put there, and are tolerated and even respected by the people.
But there's different attitudes that those elites could hold. They could hold an attitude that says we want to be as trusting and transparent with the people as possible and trust in the good judgment,
yes,
the will of. Or you could say this is a kind of unwashed mass that can't deal with the truth. It's too much for them. Let's obfuscate. Let's even deceive in order to achieve what's ultimately good for these people who have placed us here.
How are you going to do that? It's a free country. If you try to deceive the people, you will be opposed by people who will expose you. So you can't really do that. The only way you can gain power in our country is to organize a party and discover principles in a party that will gain you a majority of the people.
Jack Beatty, come in there.
That majority necessarily has to be a kind of simplification. Don't forget from that quotation that you gave from Churchill.
Yes.
He said, truth has a bodyguard of lies. He said he didn't say that lie was the essential thing, but it's a bodyguard.
Yes, fair enough.
It's the way we use the word spin. And there's an essential truth, and you try to spin it in your direction.
Jack, what about it? Harvey Mansfield is making the case, if I don't mischaracterize here, that in this country you just couldn't get away with this. It's a democracy. People are going to see the lies. It won't happen.
Well, I mean, our recent history argues that that's not so. I mean, Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Vietnam War. Again and again and again, we know that elites in power have lied to us, that they have not leveled with us. Presidents have lied to us, have not leveled with us. And it has taken sometimes years after the fact to find out. Sometimes it was found out contemporaneously, and the presidents and their people suffered, as in Watergate, and as in Iran-Contra. But the point is, stuff is always going on behind the scenes, and elites are always scheming and plotting to maximize their political opportunities. There's nothing sinister about that, but the sinister part is that we're not in on it.
Shadi Drake, what do you make of George Bush's role in all this? I'm sure he was sincere when he put Jesus Christ up as his political philosopher. He's no doubt not a Straussian. But how do you see his role in the kind of drama playing out in Washington right now, where he is surrounded by some number of followers of Leo Strauss?
Well, Strauss had a hierarchy of persons, and the hierarchy was there was three types of people: philosophers, gentlemen, and ordinary heathens, you know, ordinary masses. And the philosophers were for the most part the atheists who realized that there is no God, that there is no rational foundation for morality. They realized the nihilistic and dangerous truths, but they were determined to conceal these truths because they are dangerous for society. Gentlemen are people who really believe in God, who believe in honor, who believe in principles. They're lovers of honor and reputation and things of that sort. And the keys for the best world, gentlemen rule, but are influenced by philosophers. And philosophers can influence gentlemen to do sometimes things that gentlemen, it's beneath gentlemen to do. You can influence them to say, oh, well, you must lie to the masses because the masses are only interested in sort of drinking, gambling, and whoring. And if you don't lie to them, you won't get them to do the right things that will support true principles.
So in that dynamic, George Bush becomes the front man, as it were, politically.
Exactly. And the stupider the gentlemen are, the better things
goodness,
will go.
Shadia.
None
of that is in Strauss. You take his description of the political situation as it was in ancient times with gentlemen and their relationship with the philosophers, and you try to transport that to democracy, and you misstate his position in philosophy. He's not a postmodern. He's not a nihilist. He believes in natural right or natural justice. In other words, the things that common, ordinary, decent people believe have some standing and some support in reason. And so in that way, he's not manipulative.
His most famous book is called Natural Right and History. And if you have the paperback edition of that book, it sports the Declaration of Independence. But the thesis of the book is that the idea of natural rights that all are created equal and are endowed by their creator by the following rights, etc., is a ridiculous idea. And he argues in the book that there's only one natural right, and it's the right of the superior to rule over the inferior.
Shadi Drake, we've just got a minute left. In 20 seconds, Leo Strauss, supportive of democracy, corrosive to democracy?
I think corrosive not only to democracy, but I think corrosive to liberty. And that, to me, as a liberal, is more worrying than being corrosive to democracy.
And Harvey Mansfield, same question to you.
A supporter, not corrosive of democracy, and he was not manipulative, and he didn't support a secretive elite. None of that is true.
Well, everything we read about this philosopher says that he is interpreted in wildly different veins, and we've seen that tonight. We thank you both for being here. Harvey Mansfield, professor of government and political philosophy at Harvard University, thank you for coming in tonight. And Shadi Drury at the University of Regina, Saskatchewan, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was lots of fun. I want to say that he's not a great philosopher either. He's more politics than philosophy. He's destroyed discourse.
The debate goes on. We're going to have you back. Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, dissecting the metaphor of SARS. This is On Point. SARS has fallen off the radar screen for many Americans, but in Asia, the disease continues to dominate headlines. In China today, 4 deaths and 52 new cases. In Taiwan, the largest single-day jump in cases since the outbreak began. Author and physician Abraham Verghese knows that most Americans have viewed SARS merely as a strange disease in a distant land. In this radio diary, he says America's view of the epidemic has been shaped by unfair metaphors that always seem to accompany new diseases.
China's shame, Hong Kong's misfortune, America's good luck. This is how we in America seem to view the disease SARS. Indeed, the tendency to ascribe metaphors to disease, as Susan Sontag pointed out some years ago, is a uniquely human enterprise, absurd on the one hand and inevitable on the other. Such metaphors take root and hold sway. They dictate our emotional responses to a disease. Thus, the cancer metaphor is historically, and quite unfairly, one of failure or personal weakness. Cancer happens to the Hubert Humphreys of the world, to the perennial runners-up. The metaphor of tuberculosis, by contrast, is that of unbridled passion, affecting sensitive souls such as Keats. SARS quickly became invested with its own metaphors, and, just as when AIDS first came on the scene, the dominant metaphor of SARS was that of a medieval plague. And plague, whether medieval or postmodern, needs its scapegoats and its sacrificial lambs. The SARS virus sprang up in a part of China known for its exotic cuisine. The markets and kitchens of Canton, now Guangdong, could in other times have been the subject for a colorful and even mouth-watering story on one of the cable food channels. But in light of SARS, that story has been recast as an epic and cautionary tale, the emphasis no longer gustatory, but apocalyptic. Guangdong as an anti-Eden, where the flesh and blood of serpents, ducks, pigs, chicken, and other animals run together on the butcher's board and on the floors of open-air markets. From this primordial ooze, so the new mythology goes, a supervillain, SARS, is born. Thus, the first metaphor of SARS was not simply that of plague, but a Chinese plague. Then, as SARS spread out to China, to Hong Kong, and then to Vietnam and Singapore, the metaphor changed and SARS became an Oriental plague, and the metaphor began to affect business in the far-flung Chinatowns of New York, San Francisco, Seattle, and other cities. The metaphors, exaggerated, capricious, unfair, and unjustified as they may be, are difficult to bottle back up once they have been invoked. When the World Health Organization issued travel advisories for the affected countries, the SARS metaphor now came to mean economic blight. Singapore, China, and Hong Kong saw trade and tourism shrivel away. America thus far has been most fortunate and has largely been spared the disease. More important from an economic point of view, it has been spared the metaphor. The Centers for Disease Control and regional public health entities have done a great job of tracking potentially infected persons and isolating them. But let's not kid ourselves. We have also been incredibly lucky to be spared the virus and the metaphor. SARS has exposed the inequities and imbalances between the health systems of various countries, disorganized and secretive in China, well-organized and accessible in the U.S., and the metaphors SARS invokes reflect our biases and our prejudices. The virus, like so many before it, is democratic. It reminds us that we share one planet, and that even if we do not share the planet's wealth, we share its misfortunes.
Abraham Verghese is director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center in San Antonio. He's the author of the best-selling novels The Tennis Partner and My Own Country. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by